Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Do you know that this program is now in its seventh year with Progressive Radio Network? And my guest is Brad Coates, and he's actually the most frequent guest I've had, not only on this program, but before this program started, I was in Hawaii for 5 years, and that's where Brad Coates is from. Welcome to the program, Brad. It's nice to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be back, Dr. Diana.
Yes, yes. We started in 1999 when your first edition of the book Divorce with Decency was published. Now you're in your fourth edition.
And fifth edition. New one coming out next month, actually.
Okay, fifth, the update. Yes, I'm glad we're promoting this. People, and I did tell our producer, Kelsey, who is new and wonderful, that you'd be willing to give away a copy of your book if somebody has a question for you. I think you offered that last time, and I don't think anybody called, but are you willing to do that again?
We had a caller, and I did send him a book.
Oh, good. See, you have a better memory than I do.
And I will certainly do so again. If anybody calls in, we'd be happy to.
Okay, so I'm going to suggest to listen to anybody who has a question to maybe wait, for 20 minutes or so, so we can sort of establish some of the talking points, some of our areas of discussion. And if you do want to call in, it's 888-874-4888, and Kelsey will kind of pre-screen you and then put you on hold, and then you can be on the air with Brad and Dr. Diana, so Brad Coates. Well, there are so many things in your book, and I'm not surprised it's coming up on the fifth edition. The subtitle is The Complete How-To Handbook and Survivor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. And
it's a mouthful, but it really does cover an awful lot of stuff.
Yes, and you even have Can Your Marriage Be Saved? And Love in the Internet Age. I mean, you've really updated it, because in your first edition, you, as I recall, you didn't have much to say about the Internet Age because it wasn't that well established yet.
No, it's, you know, that's why I keep redoing the book. I mean, it's, the law changes, you know, somewhat with regard to what they euphemistically call family law. You know, it's actually divorce and then, you know, paternity, kids out of wedlock, custody, property division. It's all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't change unless you get a real breakthrough like same-sex marriage, of course, which, you know, is huge. You know, the laws on alimony and property division don't change, you know, all the time. What really changes is society. And that's where, you know, our discussions become so interesting, because really, the book is not just about divorce. It's about, you know, relationships in general, how to preserve them, how to end them with decency if you have to, what kind of criteria you may want to use to evaluate them, and how to like I say, kind of handle the whole soup to nuts on the psychology and sociology of marriage and divorce in American society. So that's become the most interesting part, and that certainly shifts around when you get stuff like, you know, the plethora of online pornography and stuff that totally is a total game changer from when I first started writing this book, now going on like 18 years ago.
Is it that long? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
We've known each other a long time, Dr. Dye.
Yeah. Sure glad our friendship has survived and thrived, because I certainly value you as a friend. And you know, we've had some fun times together, you and your mate, and me and my late husband Charlie, and then of course you know Brian, my fiance, so we've had some personally good times too.
You're actually a pretty fun gal. I assume that maybe that comes through to most of your listeners, but if they haven't met you live and in person, they really should.
You're very sweet. So we have very engaging conversations, and you have one of the things I like about your book is that you have factoids and quotes, and we thought we'd start out this show with on your page 306 in Divorce with Decency. And I, of course, as I always do when I write this show up later with a summary, I'll give everybody the your website, coatesandfry.com, and your last name, C-O-A-T-E-S-A-N-D, Fry, spelled F-R-E-Y, and .com. So anyway, you have, this is fun, and you thought we might want to start with this, that men are usually the first to say, I love you, about 61% of the time. And that's usually about 3.5 months into the relationship. And I was thinking about this, and I think that men may be more romantic and even affectionate than sometimes the stereotype gives them credit for. The stereotype does not give them credit.
I think that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. It's ironic because, you know, 2/3 of the time when it comes to ending relationships, women are the first ones to initiate that.
Right.
So, I think it speaks to the difference between the genders. Women have a little more serious list of criteria that they want to see met in a relationship, and probably take relationships more seriously, you know, in general than do guys. I mean, guys, you know, probably more tactile, which is probably a euphemism for horny. Maybe more effusive about the initial attraction without having thought it all the way through. A guy has an engaging relationship, a one night stand or whatever with a woman, and for him, he can just dance along to the next installment of whatever he's doing in his life. Whereas a woman has at least the next 9 months and maybe the next 18 years that she's got to think about, what the consequences of her action are going to be. And whereas a guy can just look at a girl and go, oh, she's beautiful and I'm attracted and I want her. A woman's got to think about, you know, what kind of a provider this guy's going to be, how stable he is, a whole laundry list of different issues that make these kind of choices much more serious for women, and that's probably why they're more tentative about getting into relationships initially.
Yes. So sorry, I got something something stuck in my throat, but I do want to comment here about a Kinsey Institute study of 1,000 middle-aged couples who had been, on average, they've been together 25 years. And what they found out is that the man's satisfaction increased dramatically, and this was an international study, if there was more physical intimacy, but physical intimacy not as in sex, but as in kissing, cuddling, and in general, sex, but not necessarily sex as we intercourse and that sort of thing. But caressing, sexual caressing. So the role of physical affection and its meaning for each gender is important, and I think we don't always consider that. Talk for a minute,
well,
and I'm going to get my throat cleared up.
I think probably at the beginning of relationships, I imagine there's a legitimate physical attraction really on both ends of the spectrum, both the guy and the gal, in order to make it happen. Maybe slightly, lopsided in favor of the guys being, like I say, more tactile. But, the problem is that this can drop away over a long-term relationship. And I don't want to sound like a sexist here, but I think maybe sometimes it drops away for both genders, but I think women sometimes begin to think it's less important, or they're just not as excited about it. They're a different age and, different level of lubrication or different whatever. But, I oftentimes see men coming into my office. And again, this is, I'm a divorce lawyer, and, men's big complaint oftentimes is that the physical intimacy has dropped off, and women may kind of disregard that issue at their peril. The big complaint that women have is not the physical part as much as it's the communication and the actual, the feeling of of real closeness and caring that's so important to women that men frequently, you know, fail to take into full consideration and to keep it, you know, strong. So, like I say, each gender has its different different elements of what it takes to keep a relationship going. But, you know, both communication and physical intimacy are important all the way through relationships if you really want them to stay strong.
Absolutely. And what you just said aligns with my over 30 years experience doing marital counseling. And it's usually the woman's sex drive that drops off. And sometimes it is relationship-oriented, hormonal. It's hormonal, maybe perimenopause or menopause. It can be many, many factors, but and in fact, that's why pharmaceutical companies have been trying to come up with a drug that would be similar to Viagra, which produces erections in men, but all it seems to do for women is to increase blood flow, but unless a woman really likes her partner, it won't help her. She's not even aware of increased blood flow. So it's true that women's sex drive tends to fall off sooner than men's, generally speaking. Not always, but usually.
Well, and it's funny how in a long-term relationship, you know, something that starts off having been as important as, you know, as the initial physical attraction can start to dissipate. And then if you don't use it, you lose it. And then if you go too long without using it, then you begin to not even talk about it. And then you begin to treat that as, you know, a non-intimate relationship is almost the baseline. And then you begin to accept that. I mean, you know, and then, you know, this person that you were so hot for, you couldn't wait to paw them all over. Suddenly, you know, you can't even discuss the idea of, hey, how come, you know, you haven't let me near you for, you know, 3.5 years. So it's weird how. And I see it in divorce cases all the time. You know, people can stay up and talk all night when they first meet and are, you know, the court and spark stage. And then as their relationship starts to dissolve, they can't even bring themselves to discuss what the problems are. The longer things go without being brought to the surface, those kind of issues, then the harder it is to resurface them later.
It's so true. And actually, you know, you and I talk about John Gottman's work because he's now studied marriages and relationships for 40 years, and he has some amazing data. And he found that it takes most couples an average of 6 years to seek help. And
wow.
So in that 6 years, they're often miserable, and they're not having any kind of intimacy, emotional or physical. It's sad. It's really sad. And I see some of these people who finally get themselves into my office to get help. One reason I'm so pleased, and part of it is my website, drdianawiley.com, DR for doctor. It's so well organized, thanks to Brian, my fiance. And so it comes up on people's mobile phones. And so I'm getting lots younger couples and people that have money here in Seattle who work for Amazon or who work for Microsoft, and they're getting help earlier on. And it's wonderful because they can make changes so much more readily when they're younger and before they build up with all of the emotional scar tissue that tends to build. You have on your page 306, you also talk about one half of all divorces happen by year seven. By year seven of the marriage, second unions that end in divorce likewise do after 7 years, and the famous seven-year itch, it was even a movie years ago with Marilyn Monroe, wasn't it?
A great movie, I might add. And, you know, that's kind of the hackneyed phrase, that seven-year itch, but it really bears out with the sociological studies that, you know, People will oftentimes stay married for just about that long. Oftentimes, it has to do with the if they're having children. Oftentimes, if you're going to have a couple of kids, and you know it takes a while to get one out of the chute and up and going. You know, maybe that's a 4-year deal, and then you get another one behind that, and that's another 3 years, and then you've got the 2.2 kids, and then you're sitting there looking at each other trying to figure out what else you have in common. But oftentimes people will, you know, they're biologically hardwired, if they're going to have children, to at least get them, you know, up and going.
Yeah.
And oftentimes for two kids, that's a 7-year time span.
And some important work was given to us by Helen Fisher, who's an anthropologist, and she's also a sexologist, and you and I both know about her work.
She's great.
Yeah, and that couples need to stay together from an anthropological point of view till the child is about 3 years old, and
right.
At least so that the kid isn't quite so dependent. That child is still pretty dependent, but and then her work is also important because she used MRIs to look at couples' brains newly in love and those who'd been together a while. And when there's all this talking during and can't keep your hands off each other in the early stages, that's when there's a lot of dopamine, which needs novelty, and it's the relationship is new. Dopamine is the hormone of arousal and lots of testosterone. So that's just surging through the couple's bodies. They stay up till 3 in the morning, and they can't stop touching each other. Everything's new. And then at about 18 months to, 3 years plus, then the functional MRI showed that that dopamine and testosterone then changed into oxytocin, the cuddle chemical, and vasopressin, the bonding chemical. So it goes from feeling like you're on speed to feeling like you're just good friends, like you're on an antidepressant. But sometimes in that, couples lose the sexual spark. And it's my job to help them get it back. And
a job which you do well, I might add. And that's an interesting, watching the hormonal shifts is mm-hmm. really kind of it's an interesting biological way to analyze it. And it is exactly right. I mean, the novelty can really carry the day for at least a while. And then the rubber starts to meet the road later.
Yeah, and I encourage couples to try to fake the brain out to increase more dopamine, the hormone of arousal, by playing out fantasies, making love in different places, going to Hawaii. You're already there, and I miss Hawaii a lot, but so many people.
And Hawaii's a great place to make love.
It is.
I've even made love here a time or two myself.
I think that's probably likely. Going back, Brad, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. This is off track a little bit, but I'm interested, and perhaps our listeners would be too. When were you first, because you're a California boy originally, and you went to law school at, what, UCLA or USC? Which one was it?
I was undergrad at USC and law school at UCLA, and
okay.
I was an LA boy for sure, yeah.
Right, right. And then, so what compelled you to go to Hawaii? Was it your time in Bali, or didn't you do some Peace Corps work?
Well, I was a government lawyer in Micronesia for a few years, yes.
Okay.
So I kind of got plugged into the tropics. And I just, you know, L.A. was a wonderful, wonderful town. I don't want to diss any of your listeners that are from L.A., but when I grew up in L.A. in the 1950s, it was a fabulous, fabulous town.
Yeah.
And then it just got busier and busier and busier. And, you know, sometimes wherever you start your professional career is where you wind up doing it for the next 30 years. I just couldn't see driving those freeways back and forth downtown for, you know, the rest of my career. So I came, even though I had L.A. pretty well wired career-wise, I came over here with nothing to Hawaii and started from scratch just because I thought it would be a better place to actually make a lifestyle together. Or, you know, I wound up together with my wife, and I wound up with the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii, so it worked out well for me.
And wasn't that perhaps one of the best decisions you've ever made?
Oh, no question, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And you can...
And it was a conscious decision to leave L.A. where... I mean, most of my friends graduating from, you know, UCLA Law School, they were just planning to stick around and practice in L.A. I it's like anything else. You know, when you've grown up in a place and have these really, really fond memories, and you watch it get a little bit, I won't say trashed, but, I mean, you know, L.A. became pretty urban pretty fast. you know, L.A., yeah, this is way off track, but L.A. really wasn't even started as a major city until the 1920s when the film industry discovered Southern California. So,
really,
you know, Los Angeles was, you know, was a small town for, you know, well after San Francisco, New York, Philly, Boston, every other place had grown up. But it's certainly caught up and went a little bit wild.
My great-grandparents and my great-grandfather was Charles Burton Woodhead, and he was a real pioneer in Los Angeles in the late 1880s, 90s, and early 1900s. And he put in the first wagon routes from Northern California and Arizona to bring fresh produce into Los Angeles. And then started buying real estate, which was very smart of him. And my grandmother tells stories about early Los Angeles when she could smell orange blossoms.
Oh, I mean, it was that's what it was, orange groves.
Yes, yes.
Orange County. Yeah, no, it
Orange
was...
Orange County, exactly.
It was a whole different deal.
I grew up in the Hollywood Hills.
Probably not what we're talking about today.
Shall
we move on to the next quote?
Yeah, we'll move on to the next quote. I think actually part of a good radio is telling stories, and I think sometimes the listeners like to hear stories. So I don't think it's a bad thing that we digressed a little bit. The next quote is, marital satisfaction does increase with each successive year. Once you have made it past the first 25 years, that is.
I think that's true. I think the more, you know, once you've been settled, you know, really deeply settled, it certainly stays. Certainly, if you've got a good marriage, and you go into old age. I mean, I'm 66 years old now, which is hard for me to. I just turned 66 last month. You know,
it's
shocking for me to even admit that publicly. But especially when you get to this age and you still feel 36. But you know, I'll tell you, having a good partner as you approach this stage of life really, really does contribute to your overall, you know, happiness quotient and as a human. Ironically, however. There's this phenomena called gray divorces where aging baby boomers, having lived so long and maybe having spent so much time with just one partner, that's actually the fastest growing component of divorce statistics in America nowadays is the gray divorces. And it oftentimes is people that have, you know, been married 20 years and then decide to blow it off. You know, it's a little shocking, but it's true.
Yes, and let's, so that's on sort of the downside, but on the upside, once again, John Gottman, his even fairly recent research reports that older married couples tend to behave like younger married couples outside the bedroom, too. And this is a quote from John Gottman. The surprising thing is that the longer people are together, the more the sense of kindness returns. Our research is starting to reveal that in later life, your relationship becomes very much like it was during courtship. Now, that presumes that you've hung in there, right? You've managed to stay together.
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, you really do. Mm-hmm. If you're in a stage where of your life where, you know, you're approaching retirement or, you know, maybe you're not quite as agile as you're feeling quite as healthy and go-y as you used to be, and instead you've got a partner that's very supportive of you, or you're able to switch around and start enjoying retirement years and doing stuff together, going on cruises, doing, you know, whatever, taking long walks that you were always too busy to do before. You know, it can really enhance the level of closeness at that stage of game, at that stage of the game.
Right.
You know, it really, you know, the kids are grown, you know, now that's a juncture that throws a lot of people, because a lot of people, you know, once the kids are grown, they look at each other and go, okay, now what have we got left? But if you can get past that point and realize that you do have quite amount of emotional closeness, and the kindness factor, I think, is huge.
It's huge.
You just don't want to screw somebody over if you've been their best friend for a lot of years, you know?
Exactly. You mentioned taking walks. I have couples in my practice where I'll suggest taking walks, but they need to stay in the mode of let's have fun and talk to each other and not get immediately on the walk, get immediately into problem solving, because you want it to be sort of recreational. And that includes the date nights that I often suggest. It's not very original, but it certainly works for people to have date nights where they focus in on each other and they don't try to solve all the problems that they have in their marriage. They try to talk about positive things. And they also don't talk just about the children. Too many couples get all child-focused and they forget about their own relationship.
Well, and you and I have talked on prior shows many times about the different communication styles that Dr. John Gray and Dr. Gottman allude to. And, you know, the one thing women really don't like is the male tendency to immediately go towards the problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's isolate this problem. Let's get a resolution of it. And, you know, and damn it, we're going to get this solved right now. And, you know, and the women sometimes, you know, want to just sort of talk around it about how they're feeling in general, and they don't want to have a guy, you know, kind of fix them and say, well, if you just do this differently, then that'll solve everything. That actually aggravates the situation. So there is a difference in communication styles between the genders as well.
Yes, that's so true. And I will encourage some of my couples for the woman to just put her hands on her guy's shoulders, look him in the eyes and say, you know what I need most from you right now? I need for you to listen to me. Just listen.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah,
that's right,
because
on.
I need to vent. Honestly, I need to vent, and I appreciate that you have good problem-solving skills. However, yeah. So you have another point. Your book is just filled with all kinds of thought-provoking. That's why we've used your book, and you've been a guest so many times, because there's so much here.
The fifth edition is going to be even better.
Really? Well, good. Will you send me one?
I certainly will.
Good. Thank you.
Should be out within the next month or two.
Terrific. I appreciate that, Brad. And people can get it through Amazon when it comes out next month. Is that the best way? Or
It's probably better to go through Amazon than it is trying to look for what used to be a bookstore.
Oh,
I guess they
golly.
Still got them in Seattle and some places that are more literate, but I'll tell you, in Hawaii, they're few and far between now.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that I still have a Barnes & Noble here in Seattle that I frequent, because I like bookstores. I like to go and handle the books.
I love them.
But, you know, we're older.
Hopefully wiser.
Yeah, hopefully. I think so. I think so. Your next point is the average working woman spends 102 minutes per day caring for her family versus men at 48 minutes per day. And then sort of a sub point of that is that globally, 38% of men don't do chores.
I think that's undoubtedly true. I mean, I don't know how they got this down to the minute, but
yeah.
There's no question but what women, despite having, you know, fought their way or, you know, now being expected to be in the workforce and oftentimes earning as much or more than their guy, and then they still wind up doing the lion's share of the household stuff. You know, guys basically, you know, they think they're helping out if they offer to take out the trash every once in a while. You know, the cooking and cleaning and caring for the kids still falls largely on the women, and it's been a, you know, kind of a real unfair gendered situation for a lot of working women. I mean, women fought so hard to get to the point of parity in the workplace, but they may have gotten more than they bargained for, because now they're working just as hard at their day job and still doing, like I say, the bulk of the heavy lifting for the family. And then when you talk about globally, you know, there's plenty of cultures where, I mean, American men have sort of been shamed by the feminist movement into actually contributing some. And our next quote is, one in five men with kids is now a stay-at-home dad in America. So, you know, it's definitely the gender roles have switched in the U.S., but try that in Asia or Africa, where they're kidnapping the Boko Haram women. Boko Haram is kidnapping 300 schoolgirls and raping them.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, being one of five wives of a you know, a jihadi Islamic dude, you know, the rest of the globe's got a ways to go to catch up.
Yes, and you and I have talked a lot about over the years John Gottman's work, but his new book is The Man's Guide to Women, and here's a quote from this book, the newest. What men do in a relationship is, by a large margin, the crucial factor that separates a great relationship from a failed one. You know, he used to say it was more on the woman, but now he's sort of shifting. And then he says, this doesn't mean that a woman doesn't need to do her part, but the data proves that a man's actions are the key variable that determines whether a relationship succeeds or fails. And so I think, and that's the end quote of John Gottman, I think men are beginning to step up at home and value the work-life balance almost as much as women, a good many men, right?
In America,
and I think
Yes. Recent
scholarship has reinforced the value of old-school habits, too, like having family dinner and saying thank you. And actually, all of these things can make a difference.
Well, that, like I say, that's certainly true in the U.S. It's a little less true in a lot of other parts of the world. I mean, the Western
right.
world has kind of come of age on all this stuff. And frankly, when you talk about whether it's going to be the success or failure, I mean, nowadays, when you've got, you know, I think the last statistic I read is that, you know, when both halves of the couple are working, you know, it's 35-40% of the time, the woman is out earning the man, which is a total turnaround from, you know, my mother's, you know, leave it to Beaver kind of a marriage where, you know, I mean, the women stayed at home and they did that. They took care of the house and then husband came home with a paycheck. Now
and that
women
was
have
mine,
got a paycheck.
My family too.
Was everybody that was our age. Yeah.
Yes.
But now
yes.
that women's paychecks are equal to guys, you know, if the guy doesn't prove his worth in a relationship, you know, women are in a position to cut and run financially that they didn't used to be in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, guys, you know, in the Western world, guys have got to be start to measure up or they get ostracized. I mean, your wife's going to the Women's March on Washington. You know, she doesn't want to hear about, you know, the fact that you want to sit there and watch sports all day. So it's a different world. And women are in a position now where they can act on it.
Careers make it simpler for women to imagine a life without a spouse. There's no question. You know,
oh,
they
totally.
Have their own income, a network of friends and associates, and their own retirement savings.
And women,
of course,
you know, women yes. at advanced ages, you know, if you're 60 years old and you're getting divorced as a guy, your wife suddenly comes to you after 30 years of marriage and says, "Hey, I'm out of here." You know, guys are a basket case. They haven't learned to, you know, cook, clean, shop. You know, they don't have any network of friends. They don't, you know, I've seen a lot of guys just totally collapse, and that's why men will quickly race down the remarriage route trying to get, you know, some new gal to remarry him within the first couple of years, whereas women, they get divorced at 60, and they've read Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, or they've read Jane
right.
Fonda's Prime Time, and they go, you know, I'm much happier just being a single female than I am, you know, having to take care of some guy again. So women oftentimes do not rush back into marriage or get remarried at all, and they don't really want to. Whereas guys are really adrift if they don't have a gal in their life a lot of the times.
You say in your book, most Hawaiians remarry following their first divorce, within about 3 years. And by Hawaiians, you don't mean just of Hawaiian descent.
I'm talking about Hawaii residents.
Hawaii.
I'm not talking about native Hawaiians, no.
Right, right.
Hawaii is, that's just the statistics happen to be here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's more likely for men than it is for women.
Yes, yes. Well, men are more likely to be dependent, as you've said, dependent on the relationship and for things getting done. And with my clients, I, as a way to talk about avoiding too much codependency, I'll suggest that they look at the difference between want and need. And ideally, in my view, you should be able to say, I want you even more than I need you. You know what? I can live without you. I can live without you, but I can live better with you. That's
great way of putting it.
Yes, I think it is. I can live better with you, but I can still live without you.
Well, that's kind of, you know, the best marriages are people are between two strong people that could be standalone, folks, but have made a deliberate choice to invest more of themselves into a couple in configuration. It's been shown time and again that if you can do that, your physical health benefits, your financial health benefits. It's probably the best model for raising children. Although a lot of children are being raised by single parents. I mean, this is kind of like I say, we're fighting a receding tide on all this. But you know, if you can put together a marriage and then make it work, it's way better for everybody than the kids and the parties themselves, financially, physical health, everything. You know, that's why there's an interesting situation that's arising right now where the upper class people. People that have good jobs, good educations, college educated people are more likely to stay married than non-college educated. You get somebody who's a strong, bulwark by your side, and it can really improve things. And a lot of smart people that have structured their lives to be achievers, they're smart enough to realize that. Whereas a lot of people that kind of stumbled into a relationship by accident and haven't really developed the skills or the financial wherewithal or whatever it takes to keep it together, they're in a much more precarious situation. That's where the divorce statistics are still on the rise, is amongst the lower echelons of society. I don't want to sound like a smartass here, but that is what's happening.
Yes, and some demographers, how do you pronounce it? They've hypothesized that the reason marriage is most popular among the highly educated is that the highly educated see it as the optimal way to give advantage to their offspring. But then, they'll some of them go ahead and divorce after the kids have left, and then you have the empty nest divorce. But in a lot of these marriages with children of highly educated people, the children are not merely fed and educated and sheltered. They are curated, or as family scholars put it, raised using concerted cultivation. And that's a concerted cultivation. Some kids are definitely overscheduled. But that's another another show, perhaps. But
helicopter parenting, yeah.
Yeah, and they have too many. They can't just play. You remember how when we were kids we could play? I had all of Griffith Park to play in, go running up and down to the observatory. It was wonderful. But these days kids are taken from one lesson to the next, and one sports event to the next,
That's another problem in relationships. I mean, this whole helicopter parenting thing. I mean, I suppose your kid does have a better chance of becoming a concert pianist if you start him with, daily lessons at age three. But, then you get this situation where the parents are so focused on their kids and their kids' schedule and paying for all these private tutors and all this other crazy stuff that they forget to focus on their own relationship, and that can be really dangerous, too.
Absolutely. I see it a lot in my practice, and you see when people come to you for a divorce, you see the results of maybe an over-focus on the children and where the couple's relationship gets neglected.
There's another interesting situation that I'm starting to see, and this is a little off track from the quotes we were talking about, but I'm seeing more and more where relationships are breaking up because of I'll have a guy come into my office and he'll say, my wife of 30 years is leaving me. And I'll go, what happened? She got another guy. What the heck happened? Our daughter, our son and his family have moved to the mainland and they've got these cute little grandkids. And my wife would rather spend time with the grandkids than she would with me. And that's,
oh, dear.
That's actually starting to happen, too. I'd never noticed
yeah.
that before.
Oh, yes. Wow.
Focusing on the kids to the exclusion of your relationship is probably not all that great an idea, but...
Well, I don't think so. You know, with my daughter and son, and now the two, I'm so lucky to have two grandsons. But with my kids, I've always really, really tried to be supportive without being intrusive. And I think I've mainly succeeded at it because I have a good, healthy relationship with both my kids, who are young adults and functioning very well, I'm glad to say.
Actually, they're probably not even, young, they're probably not so young adults at this point, Diana.
Well, they're not. My daughter is 40, and my son is 36.
I hate to bring that up, but none of us are quite as young as we thought we were, including our kids.
But you remember my daughter from, early, about 2001 or two, when we were all in Hawaii. And, so that's a while ago now.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the mother of older kids, for sure.
Shocking as that may seem. It's amazing how they can get older and we stay the same.
Oh,
I
know.
Shall we move on to the next quote about 80% of Americans having been married in 1950?
Yeah.
But that it's down to only about 48% as of the 2010 census. I mean, this is a major, major change in society. It used to be that everybody... you know, felt the need to get married. That was the way relationships got formed. I mean, you came right out of college, you married your college sweetheart, you know, oftentimes within a year or two of graduation, you started having kids, and, you know, in your early 20s, mid-20s, now people aren't getting married till, and women are, I think it's the average age is 29, and guys are 30 or, you know, right in that zone, and then they hold off on having the kids. We've got a whole different situation where people oftentimes don't get married till later. They don't get married at all. I mean, this is the first time that 2010 census was the first time in American history that the number of unmarried American adults exceeded the number of married American adults. And, you know, that has a
huge fascinating
effect
yes.
on society.
That, it's fascinating. So unmarried adults...
outnumber the married adults.
Outnumber. Now. Outnumber is the word, yes. Outnumber. Isn't that something?
The next quote is right along the way. The number of unmarried couples living together is up tenfold since 1960. So people are either not getting married, they're staying single, they're cohabiting, they're having kids, but without benefit of clergy. Half of the kids in America that are born to women under 30 are born out of wedlock nowadays. You know, when we were growing up, you had a kid without being married. You know, you had to put him up for adoption. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you know, the Catholic clergy would have you putting him up for adoption. I mean, it was a whole different deal. Now it's commonplace. I mean, I've got something like 16 secretaries in my office, and probably only two of them with kids are married, and probably seven or eight of them without have kids but not married.
Not married.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really hard to predict. I mean, you love to see everybody have their own personal freedom and live life however they want, but it's like the Surgeon General report on smoking in the 1960s, you know. I mean, you know, how do you predict that, you know, that 40 years down the line everybody's going to have lung cancer? You know, who knows what the impact of raising kids in a single parent configuration or same sex. And I'm not dissing any of this. Don't get me wrong. I mean, everybody's got to do whatever they got to do, but who knows what the difference is going to be between raising kids between a couple of homosexuals who have adopted, or somebody who's had a kid but never married the father, or somebody who's had two or three other men enter their life, other than the natural father of the child. And, you know, how do you explain that to the kid growing up, and what's the impact of that? And, you know, what's the change? How does this differ from, you know, the nuclear family that used to stick together for benefit of the children? It's pretty hard to predict what that's going to amount to. Maybe it's going to make for really independent, resilient kids, or maybe it's going to make for a lot of troubled youth. Nobody can really say, but it's going to change the world as we know it.
Yes, it will. And the kids, children of divorce, or children with an unmarried mother who maybe has a lot of men sort of coming in and out of her life. Yeah, it can contribute to some difficulties. You probably, in your studies, have looked at Judith Wallerstein's longitudinal studies of children of divorce.
Oh, of course, yeah.
and children of divorce don't have to be doomed, but it takes a lot of sensitivity. And do you want to go on?
Well,
inevitably,
when Dr. Wallerstein interviews these kids whose parents divorced, you know, 20 years ago, and they're talking to them later on about how that divorce affected them, inevitably the first thing they say is, you know, the thing that hurt the most was not my parents getting divorced, but having lost contact with one or the other parent. And that is, you know, it may not even be the divorce itself, but, you know, the divorce precipitates a situation where then, you lose either the male or the female role model in your family, and, you know, things start to potentially go sideways from there. So that's very hard for kids to recover from.
Absolutely. I remember the study. She started them in the 70s. And so her kids ended up in three groups. And the top group, who fared the best, had regular contact with each parent on a schedule that was predictable.
Right.
And they did not make the kids, the parents did not make the kids message carriers, because the kids already have divided loyalties. And
it's funny because a lot of parents who are divorcing don't want to hear this. You know, they're viewing the divorce, if they're the ones especially that want it, they're viewing the divorce as being a real positive development in their life. They're moving on to some new relationship or sick of the old one or whatever, and they tend to think that, well, because this is going to be a positive era for me or turn of events for me, you know, that, you know, maybe the kids somehow will just suck it up too, and, you know, it'll be positive for them. And a lot of people think, well, it's better to, rather than have a kid grow up listening to his or her parents fighting all the time, it's better to get divorced and you know, mellow things out. And, you know, the kids that go back and you survey them later, they say, hey, I would have rather that that my parents had stuck together and kept fighting. I just would have rather they stayed together.
Yeah, but researchers show that if the relationship is really toxic, where there's all this fighting, it is better for the child.
Well, yeah, and I'm not talking about like domestic abuse kind
and
of fighting. I'm talking
abuse.
About just,
know
you know, parents
not.
Arguing
yeah.
and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
yeah.
If you got an abuse situation, you got to get out. You got to get out. I mean, there's all kinds of statistics that show that, you know, abuse. Some of these bad habits just don't go away. You know, I mean, if you get somebody who's really got a problem with alcohol, got a problem with gambling, got a problem with anger management,
right.
Then you really probably do need to get divorced, because, you know, it's very hard to rein that kind of stuff back in. You know, you can put people
right.
in therapy and try and turn them around, but, man, it's tough.
You have a quote in your book on page 330 from one of my favorite people in history, Mae West. She was a woman ahead of her time. She said, a woman has got to love a bad man once or twice in her life to be thankful for a good one. And I think that's very true.
I think that probably is true. In the time we got left, we could talk about some of these quotes that are at the end of my Divorce with Decency book, because they are kind of interesting. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of well known that, you know, at least, you know, the famous kind of assumption is that women sometimes will be attracted to bad men in the expectation that they're somehow going to change them.
Right.
And that's that doesn't always come to pass.
Well,
sometimes
rarely
bad guys
comes
just stay
to pass.
Bad. Yeah.
But that is kind of
the mythology, is that, you know, somehow we'll change them.
Right, and sometimes women are attracted to a bad man, I'm putting bad in quotes, because it seems familiar. They come out of families of origin where there's a lot of dysfunction, and the scatological metaphor that I use is the room smells like shit, but it's a familiar smell. So they go with the familiar, because, and they may, it may also reflect on some of their own self-esteem or self-confidence. And that's why I think it's really a good thing. I'm biased, but for a single person looking for love, to do their work, to do maybe through therapy, maybe through self-help reading, but to do the work that they need to do so that they are more healthy and balanced, and then they're more likely, because water attracts its level, right, that they're more likely to attract a healthy person. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you know, if you want to have a healthy relationship and have a healthy spouse or lover, it's probably smart to start out being as healthy as you can yourself.
That's right. And
toxicity just breeds toxicity.
That's a very good way to put it. I'm going to quote you on that. Toxicity breeds toxicity. And it really does. And people get accustomed to it. And, yeah, it's unfortunate. Let's go to some more of your quotes. I guess we're not going to have a caller for this show, but presumably people are listening.
I get to keep my book.
I
get to keep my book instead of having to send it. I sent one to somebody in New York, I think, last month.
Yes, you did. I think it was somebody in Brooklyn, actually. You have another quote.
We can start with a couple of them. The one that I've got that's kind of an anonymous quote at the very beginning of the section is this one about a man wanting to be his gal's first love and a woman wants to be his last.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I like that one.
That's kind of a telling one. And again, it goes back to what we talked about the man's hoping that, you know, it's going to be the court and spark and the romance and, you know, and you know, maybe she's, I mean, the old days, and is she a virgin, you know, whatever. You know, women want to get past the silly stuff, have a man get it out of his system and have him be a more viable provider or, you know, serious mate. And, you know, she'd rather be catch him when he's a little more evolved, shall we say.
Yeah. Yes, I think that this may reflect, too, that many men do have this more romantic streak, and then there's that sexual thing that they don't, some men really don't want to have a sexually experienced woman.
Compared negatively to other guys, perhaps.
Well, I think that's true, you know. Like after Charlie's death, about a year after the death, maybe a year and a half, I started some online dating, and I did not put down that I was on my profile that I was a sex therapist. I put down that I was a marriage and family therapist and a gerontologist, all of which is true, but I didn't, because I found that it was like a filter, and some of the guys that I went out with, once they found out I was a sex therapist, were a little intimidated. I would know so much, you know.
Yeah.
And, well, I do know a lot.
Yeah, I would have been intimidated dating you.
Oh, come on. Not you, Brad. Not you, Brad.
No, but it is true. You know, the guy wants to be, you know, put on a pedestal somehow, mm-hmm. Whether it's deserve it or not. And, you know, women have got, like I say, they've got more exacting standards. Just, you know, this ties in with what we started the show about. You know, who's going to be the first to say they love, you know, they fall in love and say they love you. You know, guys oftentimes want to be romantic, but without maybe the, you know, extending to the depth of what all that romance entails, whereas the women say, well, you know, okay, so I know you want to sleep with me, but, you know, what's going to happen, you know, when we wake up?
Oh, indeed. I'm going to quote you on that one, too. I know you want to sleep with me, but what's going to happen when we wake up? You don't want to turn to the person and say, well, what's your name again?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This is another program, but so many young people now are hooking up with Tinder and they're just having hookups, and maybe there's a place for that. But I talk to some young people, they find it's not very satisfying ultimately. The hookups.
You know, if you lose me on that one. You know, I like sex as much as the next guy, but you know, you want it to be tied in with, you know, a fact that they really like you and you really like them. And
yes,
just because they're only a couple blocks away and easily reachable on Tinder doesn't really fit that bill necessarily.
Exactly.
Although,
right.
You know, I mean, everybody, I mean, you know, it's headed towards a situation where half of all marriages are coming off of the internet. So, you know, it is, you know, there are all these other sites besides just the hookup sites. I guess you got to be selective.
Yeah.
I've been married so long that I was married pre-internet, so it's never even occurred to me to do any of this stuff. But
right.
But it is tricky.
Well,
let's move on to the next quote.
I met Brian on Match.com, and it's worked out really well. Okay, you also have a quote.
But Match.com is now being overtaken by Tinder. You know,
oh,
I mean, it's
dear. I'm surprised.
Well, I may be exaggerating. I don't have the exact statistics at hand, but you know, everything is instant gratification.
Yeah.
If you can't pull it off of your phone and make it happen right now, you know, the attention span of these new generations has shrunk. It's got to be almost immediate. When we have to start advertising for my law firm, you know, you don't put it in the yellow pages anymore. It's got to be on the internet. You've got situations now where Match.com and Christian Mingle and some of these places that, you know, these sites that are really trying to hook up people that might actually have stuff in common and go to the trouble of actually, you know, detailing what that might entail, are not as popular as, you know, hey, me and the guys are at Joe's Bar, you know, down on 32nd Street, and I see from your GPS that you're only two blocks away. Why don't you come on over?
Yeah. It's a whole different ballgame. We're reaching the end of the program, and I'm not sure we'll have time to go through any more of your but the last quote that resonates for me big time because of my relationship with Brian is, and this is from your book, I love you not for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you.
Oh, that's one of the best.
That's one of the best. And it reflects that you're in a really healthy relationship, and that's what we all want. Don't we all want healthy relationship with good emotional and physical intimacy, right?
Well, and that, you know, and where you both make each other a better person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's like the trifecta. You know, you really ring the bell if you can make that happen.
Absolutely. And that happens in part because we have these mirror neurons in our brains. So we reflect the other person, and we do that more and more the longer we're with that person.
Yep.
So, Brad,
But you got to invest more of yourself, and you know, it really requires a more mature love to really get the maximum out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you back up, you've got to choose well. Choose well and then treat kindly. And, you know, I think pick out a good one and then get lucky. And maintaining a marriage, actually, people could get your book. And here's the music.
People should get my book. And if they want to hear more of these quotes, I'll come back on anytime you invite me. So aloha, everybody from Hawaii.
I'm going to invite you. Of course, I always do. So we'll talk off the air. Thanks, Brad, for another great
aloha,
show.
Aloha, everybody.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. Bye now.
Thank you for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.